Session number 15433.
McAleese, side. Side 7. Peter McAleese, side 7. Laundry section, you said.
Yeah, I went to work in the laundry, and the chap who was in charge of it, you know, I was in the store section where the stuff was laundered that used to come in there. The chap in charge of it was an ex-paratrooper. And he used to say, right, and do a bit of training. He always brought in coffee in the morning, gave me a cup of coffee. And then I'd get into the bathroom, and at the end of the day, I'd be cleaning out the baths, and I'd let them overflow so the place was full of steam. Can you see that? Train in the steam, you know, and really get a sweat on. You
right,
know?
I see.
And eventually came out and went back into society again.
Okay. What was the attitude of the other ex-service people?
You mean the screws?
No, well, both.
I met an ex-paratrooper in there.
Who was an inmate?
Yeah. And I'd known him. He had been in the Guards Parachute Company, and you know, I mean, his cell was immaculate. He was an ex-guardsman, you know, and that was his thing. And there was not a lot of ex-soldiers there, you know, and from various offences. But you know, the thing that actually came to light, there was all sort of drink-related offences.
Really?
Yeah. With the ex-soldiers.
Broken families? I mean,
And the other thing is I did a course in sociology when I was there. And we started, studying, and, you know, one guy came in and gave his story, and he got on about he'd been in Popsky's private army. And he had a limp, and he'd killed 17 Germans with his bare hands. And the last German picked up, he hadn't killed him properly, you know, he'd only half killed him, you know. And the guy picked up a machine gun and shot him in the leg, we used to listen to these people and what makes an ex-serviceman behave in this way, or, you know, why is it this element of society is, you know, we feel the privilege and, you know, behaviour of different groups of people. And does man make society? Does society make man? Anyway, this guy, you know, after further investigation, we found out his leg had actually been smashed in a traffic accident. He'd never it's a prison culture, or the prison subculture. What happens is the men do an immense amount of reading. And, you know, if a person's been in prison all their life, all they can talk about is what they did from 8 till 6, isn't it? I mean, every day of your life is marked on a board there in prison. You know, there's a board that says 6 o'clock. You know, Ravalli, 6:05, slop out, so-and-so and so-and-so, till you go to bed at night, it's there. And, you know, there's another guy there, I reckon, that he used to love climbing, and he financed his climbing through crime. And he was on about the Annapurna, you know, the north wall of the Eiger. The guy had never done any climbing, he'd read books on it. You know, he must have broken into an awful lot of gas meters because that's what he's in here for. You know, when they used to get those old gas meters, we put the shilling pieces in them. And, you know, I got with another guy who, you know, was convinced he was a paratrooper. You know, and when I told him he was a liar, you know, he just says, no, it's you that's never been in the parachute regiment. So I just left at that, you know.
Did you have any more fights when you were in there?
Yes, I'd won. I was handing out shirts, and this guy said, look, I've got a visit, give me a starch shirt. Pardon me. I says, certainly. I says, what size? I think it was a 15 or 16. I put the shirts down. He says, they're no good to me. I want a starch shirt. I says, mate, that's all I've got. He says, do you realise I'm doing a 10? I says, mate, you know, it still doesn't make any difference. That's all the shirts I've got. And I got the old, same old routine. I'm going to get you fixed. And I says, well, I'll give you something to fix me for. So I leapt over the counter, and lucky enough, the guy that used to look after me was at the back of the stores. I dragged him into kitchen, the bathroom.
Looked after you. He was who?
He was a screw.
Yeah.
So he was wanting the back. So I leapt over the back, laid into this guy and came back out as if nothing had happened, you know. And but they always knew, you know, and because I think they sometimes, to a certain extent, I was probably doing their work for them. I was doing the things they'd have loved to have done themselves. Yeah. Because, you know, I found the job terribly frustrating. And
I'm presuming you mark these people.
Pardon? I've never been into that type of thing. You know,
no, what I'm saying is they must have had a bruise.
It
was obvious that they've been... They've been hit.
And I was very fortunate that it never carried on, but I couldn't stand this. You know, I felt that we were in there, and we were all in the same boat, and I felt that all we could do is hang on to your self-respect. Mm. And, and if we start this carry on, I'll give somebody a nouns to take you out. You know, it's petty. Mm. And they were all gangsters. You know, none of them were in there because they'd been caught. None of them were in there because they'd failed in crime. We'd all failed, can you see that? Mm. But they couldn't accept it. Every one of them was grassed. They never got caught through stupidity. Mm. And every one of them had marvellous marriages. Mm. The marriages were all marvellous. You know, they've got a marvellous wife. They've got £10,000 salted away from their last job to be picked up and leave the neck, you know. And it was just complete make-believe. And out of the prison population, there's about 5% of them could actually live off the proceeds of crime. Mm. You know, some of the overspill from mental hospitals. Some are people who have gone wrong. Some are in for misdemeanours. But, you know, the actual criminal element of a prison population that could actually live off crime is probably about 5%.
Did you find, out of interest, and there anybody there that you actually thought hadn't done anything?
No. The Nick I was in. Everybody was in there for something, you know. But, you know, the... No. You see this modern thing now, you know, so-and-so was stitched up, you know, by the police. Everybody, it was a small nick I was in, everybody in there deserved to be in there, you know.
Right.
They could give you 1,000 reasons why they shouldn't be. But the reality of it was we deserved to be there.
Was there anything between the... I mean, if a screw was dealing with ex-military and he was dealing with somebody who at that time was also ex-military, did they get any slightly different treatment or...?
No, I think what it was... It's
more on the same wavelength.
Perhaps. Yeah, what it was is you knew if the guy said something, he talked the same language as you. Can you see it?
Yeah.
And you tended to do it because you didn't want to let down the system.
Right.
Even because if a guy... I mean, a screw would come up to you and say, I heard you were in the parachute regiment. Do you know so-and-so? They'd even say that to you, you know.
Okay.
Did you know so-and-so from the SAS?
Did they wear medals at that stage?
Yeah, they wore them, didn't they? Yeah.
Right. What was it like actually, you know, getting banged up? It's a big cliche, but getting banged up for the first time.
Oh, it was terrible. And, you know, it was a loss of freedom because I went to Nick through stupidity.
Mm.
It was through a woman.
Mm.
And the thing is, you know, I was locked up at 12 o'clock. And she was out with another man at 6 o'clock that night, or 7 o'clock. Can you see that? And I went, what am I doing here? You know, why have I brought this upon myself? And the message never really got through to me. And you know, and when it did, it was almost like worth having done it, because I learned a lesson, and I've always learned lessons the hard way.
Yeah.
Mm. Always, you know, and you appreciate it. Ever since then, I mean, I've never really been in trouble.
Yeah. I was trying to establish, go through, you wind up, you're in the cell.
Yeah.
And a couple of other people, how many were in the cell?
You get three in a cell.
Right.
And some of the living habits get on top of each other. You know, I'm a non-smoker.
Right.
And you get guys with dog ends, and the smell of tobacco tends to...
Right. Like, what's the opening conversation I was going to say?
A guy comes in and says, how are you doing? And where are you from? I mean, I was in fact, I met the guy in Birmingham. He came into the cell. And he's carrying his blanket. Says, "How are you doing, mate?" And I've never seen they call it doing your bird. Can you see that? And he came in. I says, "How long are you doing?" He says, 4.5 years. I'm doing 9 months and feeling sorry for myself. So he made up his bed. And it was we're in a prison to be categorised. Can you see that? So they look at you for about a month and then they categorise you.
Who are these screws?
Screws, aye.
Yeah.
And this guy Murphy came in, Spud Murphy. And he just sat and he says, Peter, I get drunk and I knife somebody, you know, and I'm paying the result of it, you know. the least I can do is do it, get it over with and get out, you know. It's surprising the amount of people who actually, when they're in there, are fairly truthful. Mm. You know, but there's, you probably get about 10-15% are totally honest with themselves, you know.
Mm.
I mean, I got banged up with two guys and it was, I thought I was going to go insane with them. So I just went, I went down to the medical officer and I says, you know, you need to put a cell, put me in a cell on my own. She says, why? I says, well, it's driving me crazy in there. You know, I feel I'm being tortured. You can't come in here telling me what do I want. I said, well, I'll tell you what. I says, if you don't give me a cell here on my own, I says, I'm going to burn down the one I'm in. Don't you talk to me. I said, well, I've come to you and told you that I feel I'm being mentally tortured.
What was the problem with these two guys?
They were bullshitters, you know, and they were petty thugs, and they'd sit there talking all day long about crime, and, you know, and it just used to get to me, you know. And you know, I had nothing in common with them. Mm. And I says, I'll tell you what, if you don't do it, I'm setting the cell on fire. I have told you.
Couldn't he have disciplined you for that?
Yes, he could. He could. I say, he says, you'll go in solitary. I says, isn't that what I'm asking you to do?
What did he say to that?
Who do you think you are? And there was a big chap there called Sewell. He was he was about 6'4". And he says, Michael, come here.
He's a screw.
Aye. Yeah. He says, what's wrong, son? I said, I'm in a cell there. I says, I feel, you know, I'm going to go off my nut. I said, I feel I'm being tortured with, you know, with this type of people. I says, look, I'm in here the same as they are. But, you know, I need to be in a cell on my own. Go and grab your kit. Pack my kit and move me into a cell on my own.
Really?
Aye. And,
it's luxury.
Yeah, that's what I wanted, you know. And
how long did that remain?
I stayed like that, and then they moved me into a hut.
Hut.
Yeah, like a barrack room. Mm. You know, I did my last month in there.
Mm. In Gloucester?
Yeah, yeah.
You get time off for remission, or?
Yeah, I got total time off.
All right. Unbanged up.
Pardon?
You're unbanged up.
Aye.
Right?
But you know, there was an anticlimax, you know, when you come out of there, and then when you walk through that door, you realise the game's on again. Can you see that?
Yeah.
I went straight back to Hereford, and this woman's waiting to me again. She's fell in love with me again. Can you see that? And honestly, you know, when I look back at it now, you know, I feel that at that time, you know, I needed a good flogging, you know. Yeah.
So what happened? She was waiting for you, proverbially.
Yeah. And the same, you know, it went fairly steady for another couple of months.
Mm.
Then I was back in again.
Back in?
Back in Nick.
Oh, God.
So I went back in and I...
How long did you get this time?
6 months, yeah.
Back in Gloucester?
Yeah.
Thank God.
And...
Did you do a job between the two?
Yes, I was working on demolition.
Could you work, but being near explosives with the record, would that normally the two be allowed or go to?
No. It wasn't explosive.
It wasn't explosive demolition.
Ah, yeah.
Right. So you're back in. So what happened then?
They just went, missies again. Yes. It was a fairly uneventful 6 months. I went, and then I came out, and she was waiting for me again.
So what did you do?
Went back again.
For the third time?
For the third time, and then I got 9 months.
Again.
And then...
What was this, the same magistrate, or a different magistrate?
No, the...
Different magistrates.
Aye. And I appealed against this one, because, I was really given the gears on it, you know, and by the mother-in-law. And, she'd literally set me up with the police, you know, and created the incident.
No, really?
Yes, yeah. And I appealed against it, and I tried to defend myself. You know, I didn't have money for solicitors and that. And as I say, on the last trip to prison, or as I said in my book, back to weight training and calligraphy again, I did a bit of arithmetic. I said, I've been involved with this woman for 6 years. I spent 2 years of it in jail. and the rest of the time has been fighting with him. And I actually wrote in a diary, Peter, you know, you need to look at yourself. Mm. And I came out, and she was waiting again. And I just said, I'm sorry. And it was like, when I walked, I turned my back on her, and I walked up the road, and what a feeling of freedom, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I felt I'd overcome something in myself.
Right.
And, you know, it is, it's a criminal record. It was a long time ago, but I feel, you know, I cannot really say I've got a chip on my shoulder about it, because it gave me breathing space. Can you see that?
Uh-huh.
And it got me on a better course, you know.
Right. Where did you live and what did you do after that?
I lived in a little flat with an ex-SES guy called Barry Madison, and I got myself a job in the oil rigs.
Mm. Which is well paid.
Yeah.
I presume. Yeah,
and of course, I was working away, toing and froing from the rigs. And
so you were living where?
In the Hereford.
Oh, well, yeah. Right, a long way, yeah.
Yeah, and lo and behold, I'd become involved with this woman called Elsie, a lovely, lovely woman. And I was sitting in a flat one day and the telephone rang. And there was a sort of cryptic message, just Major so-and-so there. I says, there's nobody by that name. And the phone went twice asking me for this person. Next thing, the phone rings a third time, John Banks. I said, do you want to do a job in Angola? This is 75, early. Coming on to early 76.
We're talking about the Hilton assignment.
Ah, yeah. Now, hold on. The Hilton assignment was 1970.
Okay.
Right. I was working on an oil pipeline.
Yes.
And I was up in Scotland, and I had a telegram. And a lucrative assignment, £5,000 for a night's work, signed Lawrence Smith. He'd been the ex-RSM of the regiment. So I phoned him up, and he says, get yourself down to London. So I came to London, I went to a load of flats in Kensington.
This was before jail?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I went to these flats in Kensington, and, sorry, near 1970, and lo and behold, David Stirling was there. And so they started telling us, and the next thing is, they opened this sort of case, like it was when these cases with the combination locks first come out, click, you know, and out come the big long envelopes like this. It was like something out of a movie. Bit of expenses for you chaps, you know. So one of the guys...
Was there a group of people there?
Aye, like there's 20 of us. Aye. So, you know, soldiers are studying their own. One of the guys says, I need to go to the toilet run, and he went, there's £200 in the envelope, you know. So, I mean, that was a lot of money in 1970.
Sure.
And that was to cover us for expenses.
£20 a week.
Yeah. So, we were supposed to do a job and break into a political prison.
Where?
In Libya. Oh. And release a load of political prisoners and start a revolution in Libya, overthrow Gaddafi and bring in King Idris, you know, and put him back on the throne. Anyway, it never materialised.
Mm.
You know, I think politics intervened and that was it.
How long were you wrapped up with that then?
About 2 months.
2 months?
Aye.
And you were paid during that time? Or?
No, I got that £200 expenses and I was working at the same time.
Okay, so just, you're on standby.
Yeah.
Okay. There was another thing Stirling did in Yemen, wasn't there?
Yeah, but Stirling got involved in the Yemen. That was the late 60s.
Uh-huh.
And they were organising a load of
mercenaries.
Yeah. Mm. And they were getting involved, you know, training and leading the royalists against the Egyptians. And they had an office up here in South Ospley Street. And the funny thing was the office was 22 South Ospley Street. You know, South S, Ospley A, Street S. I don't know if it was just the way it worked out, you know. And I never got involved in that.
No. So, Banks.
Yeah.
Phone call Banks, Angola, 1976 are we up to?
Yes, January 76.
Right.
Right. John Banks phones me up, says, you know, job, 200 quid expenses to come down. So I get down there, he gives me my 200 quid. He says, job going Angola. I says, well, I'll go.
Didn't ask anymore?
No, I was getting back into the saddle with soldiering. Anyway, I go to a hotel and Banks gets there and he gives us, there's a chap there called Nick Hall, and he gives everybody the money.
200. Where was the hotel and where?
It was the Towerbridge Hotel.
Oh, well, yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And we're all in this room there and he says, right, bit of expenses. And of course, there'll be a bus to take you to Heathrow, tickets all booked up and whatnot.
But then they started having photographs and cars following them on the motorway.
Yeah, and the other thing was, is, you know, a couple of big bouncers on the door to stop guys escaping, so a couple went into the toilet and came through the toilet window. You know, we started off with, I think it was 22. He gave us the money and it was down to sort of 16 or sort of 19. You know, the guys were gapping it. Another one got lost on the way to Heathrow, you know. So I just joined up as a troopie. So we get on the aircraft and fly to Angola, and the time I get to Ndili Airport, we fly to Zaire.
To Kinshasa.
And the 10-hour flight or whatever it was to get across, and I'm promoted from, you know, troopie to captain. You know, my captain on the side. You know, what do you call accelerated promotion? So we get there and, you know, we go and have a meal with Holden Roberto and we...
Who was the...
Leader of the FNLA.
Yeah. Right.
And we get in a bus and we drive down to Angola and they take us to a place called San Salvador.
How long did that take?
It took all night.
Yeah. So it's only, what, 100 miles or something?
Yeah, but the guys are extremely jumpy. You know, we get in Kinshasa and, you know, they're giving out every one of them M2 carbines and we come to a roadblock and the next thing they're all sticking carbines at the window, you know.
And so what sort of guy? Okay, did you know any of the other people that were there?
I knew of them. Because I'd seen some of them and I do beforehand.
Okay.
I knew Dave Tompkins.
Okay.
And I got there and I says, this is insanity. You know, I said, take... Now, in actual fact, one of them slagged me in a book for it. About it, he says, this is when I doubted McAleese's leadership. What he didn't know was they were still inside Kinshasa and they were wanting to stick weapons out. I says, take your magazines off and leave them at the side.
Were you in charge? Or
yes, I was
in charge. What sort of background were these other guys then?
They were all some ex-regular soldiers, some civilians.
What were the civilians guys like?
Dave Tompkins was a civilian. He'd done a bit of time for blowing safes, you know.
Uh-huh.
He was a safe blower, so he came as a demolitions man.
But were they okay, or...?
Dave was all right, but...
The others?
Yeah, the others were... They all left the army for various reasons. I didn't know anything at this time.
Right.
So I get shipped down to Angola.
How had he, Banks, selected these people?
There was no selection. He just got the guys and banged them.
These are people that he got a list of?
Yeah.
There's a noise of a dust cart reversing. Right. Banks, he just got these.
Yeah.
As far as I can recall, they had about five. It only went on for a few weeks, and maybe five buses.
Yeah.
Went through. Went to the airport in this way.
Yeah.
Were you the first, second, third?
I was the first.
Were you?
Yeah.
What ranks were the other guys promoted to?
You had RSMs. I was a senior rank, so I'll go down and meet Carl and crosses Georges at Kinshasa. At San Salvador. Who is then a colonel.
Colonel Carl.
Yeah.
And what did you know of him then?
I didn't know anything.
What briefing did Banks give?
There was no briefing. There was no briefing to go out there. It says you'll be met by somebody at the other side.
Right.
And we would have been taken out there by a guy called Nick Hall, who was a friend of Callan's. Can you see that?
Right, okay.
So Banks supplied the personnel, and we were going out there to do the actual business.
Excuse me, we just have to shut this window. Okay, let's just speak over this noise, so we can't shut the window and so forth. Callan gave you no briefing. He said,
Banks.
Banks had given you no briefing, you wind up there.
Yeah.
Hall is a mate of Costas Georgiou. Yeah.
See, we were just told where we were going.
Right.
And then we'd be briefed when we got to the other side.
Okay, so Kinshasa.
Yeah.
And did they actually, were you given any equipment?
Pardon me. At Kinshasa, we were given a camouflage uniform, boots, hat, M2 carbines, five clips, a knife, a water bottle, just basic, you know.
And ammunition?
Yeah, ammunition as well, yeah.
Was this, and did the kit fit, or was it?
No, it fitted us, yeah. Yeah, it did fit, yeah.
Right, okay.
See, what happened later on, you had a load of guys who deserted for various reasons, and, you know, they had to give a reason for their deserting, you know. So they tended to say, oh, we didn't have proper weapons. The weapons were all brand new weapons.
Really?
They were M2 carbines. You know, they don't have the hitting power of an FN.
No.
But if they're good enough for the American Airborne, they were good enough for us.
It doesn't go fully automatic? Or
it does go fully automatic, yeah.
So, if we could just resume from... you've landed at Kinshasa. What, was it in the side of the airport?
No, we just landed at a normal passenger terminal. We stayed behind and we were all taken out through a side gate.
Right.
Because Holden Roberto was very much involved in Mobutu.
Where were you actually issued the weapons?
At Holden Roberto's house.
So you go around Holden Roberto's house and then stuff it there?
Yeah.
Okay. And what were the Zairians doing in this? Were there any Zairian liaison around?
Or? Yeah, we had a Zairian vehicle. Met us at a place called Matadi and escorted us into San Salvador.
Right. San Salvador being just the other side of the border, presumably.
Yeah.
Right. What were the... where did you meet Callum then?
San Salvador. Yeah.
What were the attitude of the other people when this was happening? They're getting jumpy, you said.
They were getting awful jumpy, and you know, they felt, you know, they felt they were going into the unknown. They didn't know what was happening, and there was, I think a bit of briefing would have helped, but you know, by the same token, I think a lot of them were having second thoughts about what they'd actually got themselves into.
Was John Namak there at that time?
John Namak came out later.
Right.
Yeah.
What happened once you'd gone to San Salvador?
We were lined up outside the palace and a chap came out and started sort of haranguing the guys, and you know, I'd tried to get the guys' haircuts before they went out there, and this guy's threatening to cut their hair with a knife, you know.
This is who?
A chap called Wainwright, Mike Wainwright.
Uh-huh.
I says, you won't cut anybody's hair with a knife, you know. And you know, a little bit of a dispute.
But what sort of a guy was he?
He was an ex-para. Him, Callan and Mike Wainwright had robbed a post office together, so they'd been in prison together, can you see?
All right.
And they were mates, and they got out there a few
weeks. They're from where, London?
From the Paris.
Oh, yeah. They'd robbed the post office while they were in the Paris?
Yeah, in Ireland.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, and anyway, Callan emerged out. I mean, an extremely fit-looking, well-built character.
Mm.
And, of course, there was all sorts of threats and, you know, everything was like the sort of wacky races, right? Get on the trucks, we're going out to get some kit. You know, so they wanted, we didn't have hats, that was it. So we're looking for other weapons as well. So I see all these guys walking down the road in their underpants, you know.
They're locals.
Aye, Callan has stripped all the uniforms off them, you know, to get this special group of his together, you know. And, you know, he'd walk up and he'd say, that man beat him up, you know, and somebody, and I say, this is crazy, you know.
And he would beat up the natives, Africans.
Yeah, and instead of, you know, getting them and trying to lead them, if they didn't do as we're told, they were beaten up.
Mm.
And I got there, I says, this is insanity. Anyway, the next thing was...
surely you must have thought of, maybe you should have go home or
Never. I looked at Callan, and, you know, and it takes a lot to make me afraid, and it made me think, because there was no guarantee in which way he was going to swing, can you see that? Totally unbalanced. I mean, and he's on about, I've had to kill five men because they don't, they won't do as I tell them. You know, and, oh no.
And he was character, he's always, did he threaten people with
firearms? Oh, he was always a, you know. And he says, like one guy came in and he asked for food. I must get food for my soldiers. He says, can you see the problems these people give me? And I went, but that is your problem. You know, I said to myself. So, I mean, I was...
Did he know of you?
No, he didn't. He didn't.
He had never heard of you?
No. And, I mean, I was too busy working to actually take heed of Callan. You know, the next thing he said to me was, I want you to go to San Antonio Desire and have a look at the place. So I...
That is...
It's right down on the coast, the Atlantic coast.
Okay.
Right on the mouth of the Zaire River.
It's a resort, it's a, what is it, a town or resort?
It was a town, yeah. So I said, yeah, okay. So I come back and she says, I want you to take eight men and go down there. So I got eight guys and they came with me. And one of the guys, a guy called Brummy Barker, said, have you ever thought of killing Callan? I said, what are you on about, Brum? You know, he said, because he's thinking about killing you.